trenches. True stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
This is going to be episode 80 of Within the Trenches, and I've got to tell you right off the bat, this is going to be huge. I mean, it's crazy for me to think that this podcast has 80 episodes under its belt already. You know, I started this adventure telling stories through a written segment on my blog, The Jabberlog, and eventually, you know, it evolved into a podcast. You know, what I wanted to do from the beginning was to tell the stories of the unsung heroes of 911, and here I am. I love doing this, and the stories are all amazing. You know, I just want to thank everyone, all the listeners, for the support throughout this journey. And this, like I said, this episode is going to be excellent, episode 80. So without going any further, I usually have a story to go along with this, but I'm not even going to tell a story in the beginning here. I'm just going to go at it and introduce our guest. And my guest today, you know, he's been in public safety for some time now, and his story is one that I wanted to cover since I heard about it from a good friend of mine. His name is Tom, and he runs the Cool Kids of 911 Facebook page. And, you know, my guest today, his name is Steve, and he's the director for Fairfax County 911 out of Virginia. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you very much, Ricardo.
Excellent. Now, like I was telling you earlier, I've read about your story. I heard about it. And it's one that I've been wanting to cover for some time because you dealt with something in the beginning of your dispatch career, which we'll get to here shortly, that I can't imagine going through myself. Now, before we get into everything, how many years have you been in public safety now?
This is my 56th year.
56 years. That is, I was a line dispatcher and supervisor for just over 13 years, and you've been doing it for 56 years. And oh, that man, that's wild for me to think. But you know, thank you for the service and the things that you've been doing. Now, how did you get into 911 to begin with?
Well, I think it might be more appropriate to go back just even before 911, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was a firefighter in the District of Columbia Fire Department, which was a lifelong ambition. I was fortunate to be appointed to the fire department in 1961 to one of the largest and busiest truck companies in Washington, D.C. About 7 years into my career, bringing it to about 1967 and 68, while on duty in the Coast Guard Reserve, which was another love of mine and a parallel career throughout my entire public safety career, I had a pretty serious knee injury, which caused me to go on convalescence leave from the military and consequently from the fire department because it occurred while I was, quote, on active duty. But at that time, I was not married, and the light duty or the no duty, if you will, the recuperation period was quite frankly driving me nuts. and I was just chomping to get back to work, but I knew I wasn't recovered enough to go back to the line, if you will, in the truck company. So I went to the fire department's medical facility and I talked to the doctor and I told them that I would like to go on, as it was called, light duty. And he looked at me kind of with a curious eye and he said, "Why do you want to do that?" Because at that time it was the early spring of 1968. And he said, "Just take the summer off, go to the beach, come back and see me in October and we'll talk about it then." And I said, "No, I really am anxious to get back to work." And he said, "Well, where do you want to go to work at?" And I said, I'd like to go on light duty at the fire department's communications center. And this is a visual, but he kind of pulled his chair back from his desk and he looked at me with a real, real cross eye. And he said, "Son, go out the door, make a left, and then make a right. And the psychiatrist is in that office."
That's funny.
Because that's the way, unfortunately, communications was often viewed back in those days.
Oh, wow.
But he says, "You're serious, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." So, he made some administrative phone calls and notified my parent company that I was going on light duty. I was coming off a convalescence leave. And then he called the communications center to tell them that I would be on duty that night, which was just about 5 hours after this conversation in the doctor's office was taking place. The date was April 4th, 1968, a date which, if you live through it, you'll never forget it. But for those that may not be familiar, it was the date on which Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Wow.
So at 4 o'clock, I reported for duty. Actually, I was there 2 hours early because that's my nature. Mm-hmm. And I walked into what was called the alarm room, the communication center, if you will. And the supervisor on duty, who was called the chief operator, said to me, "We heard you were coming." He says, "Why are you here so early?" And I said, "Well, I'm just here early." So he looked around the room and he said, "Who was here first this morning?" Meaning who had reported for duty at 8 o'clock, because back then they worked 8 hour shifts. And the guy that was on the radio had been the first one to report earlier that day. So the chief operator said to me, he says, "Can you talk on the radio?" And I said, "I think I can." He says, "Okay, you're the radio operator." So the guy that was on the radio got up and he was just as happy as a clam because he was getting out of there 2 hours early.
Right.
He says, "Sit in the chair. Here's the red button. You push that when you want to talk and the microphone is in front of you. And you have a switch with switch one and switch two," which was channel one and channel two. And that was it. You had a yellow long lined notepad there and a pencil. And they were the tools of the trade in 1968. And I sat down and it was kind of a quiet early afternoon. And then as rush hour began, things began to pick up as they always do in our world. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the rush hour had subsided, it began to taper off a little bit. And we had a TV on and it was far away from where we were, meaning in the room, but not right up close.
Right. Right.
But we did see some activity on the TV that kind of caught our attention. And what it was the report from the site of Dr. King's shooting at that time, soon to be acknowledged as an assassination. And it was very sobering. Dr. King had been very much in the news leading up to all of this. Emotions were high across the nation. They were high in Washington, D.C., for sure. And we kind of sat there with a stunned look on our faces. We listened to the news unfold about what had happened and so forth. And then we began to look at each other, and without saying a word, we began to communicate by eyesight and just our demeanor that this may be the beginning of something that's very unfortunate, because already in the nation, there were a lot of tension from the standpoint of race relations. And there had already been in some areas of the country demonstrations that got quite out of hand. There had been some fires that were set as a result of that. So we were conscious that you might characterize it as the tinderbox environment in which we were living could in fact be ignited by this tragedy that we saw unfolding before our eyes. The early part of the evening, going into the 7 and 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock portion, and recall that the doctor was shot in the central time zone, so we were 1 hour ahead of that. But at about 10 o'clock our time, in an area not too far from the communication center, we began to get calls of people assembling and marching in the street, and some disorderly conduct, if you will, some dumpsters being set afire, some cars being set afire and turned over. And all the time we're kind of doing what fire dispatchers do, take calls and dispatch units. But at the same time, you could almost feel in the air a sense of tension and a sense of apprehension building that was fostered by the tragedy that had unfolded a few hours earlier. And then at about the 11 o'clock hour, at about the time that you would normally begin to look forward to getting off duty, things really went south in a hurry. Rioters began to set stores afire, buildings afire of all manner, apartment houses afire. And here I was on the radio, and remember, please, that it was 1968.
Right.
There was no CAD. There was no 911. There were no multiple channel trunk radio systems. There were no mobile data terminals. There was no incident command system, because that's the way it was in 1968. Within literally an hour, we had major, major problems on our hands insofar as a particular area of Washington, which was only about 20 blocks north of the White House. So for the folks that know the layout of Washington, D.C., it's in the northwest section of the city, and 20 blocks from the White House is where all of this rioting and burning was occurring. And here I was on the radio with two channels, a primary channel and a mutual aid channel, and a yellow pad and a pencil. and it was, and you have to be a firefighter and you have to be a dedicated 911 person and a public safety oriented person to appreciate this. But it was, the adrenaline was flowing.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine.
You were rising to the occasion, if you will. Mm-hmm. Your mind was racing ahead. You were being very anticipatory. Because I had the good fortune of being stationed normally in that area of the city, I knew it very well. My partners were on duty that night in the field. My platoon was, in fact, working. So I knew my guys were there, and if I had not been on light duty, I would have been there with them. But as the evening wore on, the fires got worse, and then there was presidential declarations made declaring a national emergency, and the National Guard was called in, and very quickly the assets of the Washington, D.C. Fire Department became depleted, which was a fairly good-sized fire department. This is 32 engine companies, 17 truck companies, 3 rescue squads, 8 battalions. So this is not a small fire department.
Right.
And they had been preliminarily trained for the possibility of riots by nature of what had happened around the nation before the 4th of April, 1968. The gentleman that was the director of the communications center at that time, a gentleman by the name of James Flynn, and one of my greatest mentor in my entire career, a visionary of his day, but foresaw the possibility that as the tension rose in the nation long before the assassination, that the fires that had struck elsewhere might strike Washington, D.C. He had prepared a huge 25-foot-long series of plywood placards, and with very fundamental things, paper tags and little hooks that you screw into wood, and lines on the plywood that would designate jurisdictions that surrounded Washington, companies within those jurisdictions, and then the tags indicated what companies they were, as a means to, gosh forbid anything ever happen, we would have some very, very primitive, very elementary mechanism to keep tabs of who was doing what where. And by about 1 o'clock that morning, that device was brought into play, and it was the only thing that really allowed any of us to really know who was where, because things were happening so quickly on either one of two channels. And channel one, the primary, which was being used by those units that were on the scene, was as busy as you can imagine. And the other channel, which was for mutual aid, was rapidly becoming saturated with suburban mutual aid units coming into the city, looking for direction, wanting to know where to go, what to do, who to report to. So it was really a pretty challenging thing. And I'm just really, really glad that I was there. You know, in public safety, as I hope many of your listeners can appreciate, it's a passion. It's not just a job. And although you never would want to wish ill will or bad things to happen to people, but because we live in a world where stuff happens, I think a lot of us would say, if it's got to happen, I want to be on duty when it does, and I like to be on the scene, if you will. So that sense kind of prevailed, and I was just very, 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 very fortunate to be where I was. And as the day and the evening wore on, with so much stuff going on and no means of really keeping good records of it except for a pad of paper, which oftentimes you had to abandon simply because of the volume of radio traffic.
Yeah.
And somebody else was luckily working with me handling these little round paper tags, and you've seen them with the little metal thing that goes around. They're about the size of a quarter.
Yes.
And he's there, you know, hanging these things up and taking them off and moving them from here to there. So we try to track where these units are going. It was something. And as both the change of shifts normally occurred, and as the word got out, and you again know how public safety people are, when something's going on, you don't have to call them back to work. They're coming back to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And people came into the center that were on 3 days off and all kinds of stuff. So they didn't need to be there, but that's the way it is in our world. And everybody would come up and say, what can we do to help you? And let me relieve you. And it was very, very difficult to do that because you had such a body of knowledge that's kind of swirling around in your head. It wasn't like the normal change of shifts where you get up and say, listen, we got this and we got that. And you just walk away from it, and somebody else plugs in, and they take over. That wasn't the way it was. You had 100 units plus out there, all of it swirling around in your head, and all kinds of stuff going on that made a change of shift very, very difficult to do. So it was resolved that. And I was asked about this by the chief operator. He says, do you want to stay there? Should you stay there? And I said, yeah, I think I better stay here. So I had the good fortune of kind of just toughing it out. And again, to your listeners who I guess are people like me and us, you know that when really you're engaged in something, your adrenaline is flowing, and being tired or being hungry fades from your thought process. You're doing your job.
Right.
I remember vividly, although things did taper off a little bit towards 5 o'clock in the morning, it wasn't very long before things began to pick up again. And I guess I stayed there in the chair except for a quick run to the men's room from time to time, and people bringing me a soda you couldn't go out and get anything. I mean, whatever you were eating was either in the refrigerator already, or maybe by that time, the National Guard had ringed the building and they were guarding it with their weapons drawn. Tear gas was all over the place. It was a warm April, so the windows were open. We had no air conditioning, so tear gas is waffling through the room.
Jeez.
The National Guard folks brought us all gas masks, and they were, I called them snoots. They were gas masks that had kind of like a can of vegetables on the front of them. And that was the filter. And it was a filter designed for tear gas. So you had this mask on, and every time you talk, you'd have to lift the edge of the mask off and say something and then push it back over your mouth. It was absolutely crazy, if you will. But it didn't end there. I mean, it kept on going. The next day arrived. There was a Friday. Things were rocking all day long. The fire spread from one big area, and there was a lot of fire now, many hundreds and hundreds of buildings in the middle of a city. This isn't like a wildland fire that we read about today that consumed 100 houses. These are big buildings. These are 4 and 5 and 6 story brick buildings, stores. This was a big a big conflagration, but it spread from the northeast area of the city, which is kind of nearer to the Capitol building. So you had these three, any one of them would have been a conflagration. And we had three of them going on at one time. And it was interesting, the camaraderie of public safety. We're very formal, I think, when things are routine and when things are getting really, really high tension, high stress, if you will, we become to look to ourselves in a more personal way. And the radio traffic over time began to be personal radio traffic. It wasn't like Engine 11 to, it was called headquarters, communications was headquarters. It wasn't Engine 11 to headquarters. It was Engine 11 to Steve, or Steve to Truck 6. It was interesting how the firefighters in the street and the firefighters in communication center really bonded together, almost looking out for each other in totally different environments, if you will. Went this way, I guess 2 days later, I was finally able to kind of get out of there. I was engaged at that time. My fiance was obviously worried. No cell phones, folks. So no texting. You know, there's this big absence of where is he at and what is he doing and how come he's, I can't get in touch with him and all that kind of stuff that is important for today's listener to realize that even it was only in 1968. You know, it was like a century ago when you think about technology advancement of both our profession as well as society. So that's it in kind of a in an abbreviated fashion. I could probably talk for hours about all the things that happened, but it certainly was, and a lot of people have characterized it as a baptism of fire. If you want to characterize it that, it was. But the one thing that was absolutely cemented in my mind, aside from the memories of the event and all that flowed from the event, was the fact that when I got up from the chair 2 days later, I knew that I probably would never go back to the field, that I kind of found my niche, or my niche found me. I'm not sure which, but I never did go back to the field. I was always in the fire department, but my field from that point on was in the communications world. And that kind of set the foundation for my career in communications and 911 that followed.
You know, that's it's crazy for me to think that, you know, when I was in dispatch, you know, we had CAD, we had everything going on there, but you know, the way you're saying it, and you guys only had the pencil and paper, that's hard for me to think how, you know, you guys were really doing everything. How many people were in the room with you at the time?
The shift initially was five people, one chief operator, one assistant chief operator, one telephone operator, no 911 now, just telephones, one EMS dispatcher, and one fire dispatcher, because the Washington, D.C. Fire Department from early on was also the EMS provider.
Wow. I can't imagine the chaos that that you were going through. I mean, just listening to you, I was listening to the entire story. I'm in awe just to think of how all of that played out, and the fact that, you know, you guys are working on minimal tech, you know, at that time. And the whole, I mean, I can picture how you guys were pinpointing where everybody was at and doing certain things. And in my head, too, I'm thinking, I don't know that, well, you know, okay, I can say that I don't think that I could do it, but because I come from dispatch and because I've been in a situation not as intense as yours, but I've been in, you know, emergency situations where, like you're saying, the adrenaline kicks in and you are doing your job and you're going, and it doesn't matter if you're hungry or thirsty or whatever, you're just doing your job and you do it until it's done. So I might say that I don't think that I could do it, but I'm pretty sure that in that moment, the adrenaline would kick in and I would be working, you know, right there with everybody else doing what we had to do. But it's just amazing to think that you guys, you know, dealt with that. And so how many days did those riots last then?
They kind of ebbed and rised a little bit. About 9 days it took for things to really be out and under control. But every night they would flare up again under the cover of darkness, because by that time, obviously, the city was heavily populated by National Guard and real army and other military units and police units from all over the area and beyond. But at nighttime, with the sunset and the darkening of everything, and remember, streetlights are out now and a lot of other things going on, mm-hmm. It would usually flare up for 4, 5, 6 days until it really tampered down. One interesting thing, Ricardo, if I could, I had to go back to the clinic, of course, because I still had this knee that was being rehabbed.
Oh, okay.
So right. I went back there and I saw the same doctor that told me to go see the psychiatrist. And I walked in there and he says, you know, he called me Satter. He said, you knew what you wanted to do when you told me you wanted to go to communications, didn't you? And I said, yes, sir, I did. And we laughed about that every time we would see each other after that.
Oh, that's funny. Now, would you, if you think about it back now, and I know you said that, you know, the adrenaline kicked in and you were doing your job and doing what you had to do. At any point, do you remember feeling like it was nerve-wracking or maybe slightly overwhelming, or if you were nervous at any time? Because this is, you know, you're walking in and they throw you on radios and then all of this happens. So were you nervous at any time, or was it just, you know, like second nature?
I can't really say that I was nervous. Anybody that knows me probably knows that I'm not a terribly excitable person. I wasn't nervous. I guess if I had any emotions, it was that I might do the wrong thing that could cause somebody to get hurt. I mean, all these units swirling around are all chattering on the radio, and this is a bad scene. And keep in mind, it's not just the fires that are going on, but the rioters are now armed themselves and shooting at the firefighters and the military people that have been brought in, the local police force and beyond. So you could characterize the field as being a battleground, you know.
Right.
All fueled by the immense emotions that were associated with the assassination of Dr. King. So I guess the emotional part was that I might do something that could cause somebody to get hurt.
Yeah. And it's hard to not, you know, be somewhat, you know, emotional or second guess or something like that. But in this field, there's not a lot of room for that. You know, there's no room for, you know, second guessing or anything. You got to make that split decision. And, you know, as they say, seconds save lives. So, man, that is a great story and, you know, something that you live through. And so moving from that now, how long did you stay within dispatch before you ended up coming out and moving to the job that you're at now?
Well, I was a mere 7 years into my career in the fire department, and I stayed for 24 years. So I retired from the fire department and from communications in 1985, almost to the day that I went in communications, April of 1985. And I retired because I was getting, and please excuse me, and don't take this the wrong way, I was getting antsy.
Oh, okay.
I was antsy to do something more, not different, but more. Mm-hmm. And by now in 1985, 911 is, you know, a fact of life. We installed 911 in Washington, D.C. in 1977. And I might add, if I don't mind going back just a bit,
sure.
Ricardo, the Washington, D.C. Communication Center was a secondary PSAP to the Metropolitan Police primary PSAP. So when we installed 911 in the city in 1977, obviously the primary PSAP answered the initial 911 call. And then after the, you know, typical questioning, if it was a fire or an EMS call, they would transfer to the fire department. So we we all knew that 911 was coming, and there was, you know, the typical chatter in the communications room about what is this thing and will it be better or will it be worse and what will the problems be and all of these kinds of things. But in typical public safety fashion, somebody said, well, let's have a poll and see who answers the first 911 call. Well, guess what? I ended up being, you know, the next guy up, and darn if I didn't answer the first 911 call for a very, very minor fire. But that was kind of an interesting milestone in my own mind, you know, that I was lucky enough to be there when that phone rang, you know.
Right.
But to answer your other question, in 1985, I was getting a little bit antsy, and the city of the county of Arlington, Virginia, which is more of a city than a county, but it's directly across from Washington in Virginia, of course, is where the Pentagon's at and where the cemetery's at. They were combining their then independent police communication center and fire communications into a combined or consolidated communication center. One of the first in the nation to do that, not the first, but one of the first. And they were looking for somebody to be its director. And when I sat down in that chair in 1968, being a director of a 911 center or a communication center was the absolute furthest thing from my mind. But by 1968, I was getting antsy, as I said, and this opportunity came up, and it said, you know, send in a resume. I had never done a resume in my life. It said, fill out the application. I had done one of them for my only other job, the one that I was retiring from. Mm-hmm. But it sounded exciting, and I applied for it. And to my to both my amazement and my gratification, I selected to be that director. So now I find myself just across the Potomac River from where I had spent 25 years doing the same thing, just kind of pointing my car in a different direction as I went to work every morning. and I stayed in Arlington for 16 years. And guess what happened? I got the antsy bug again. Of course, by now, my wife and our family are living in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is on just the other side of Washington, D.C. And they were looking to hire their first civilian communications director. And this was August of 2001.
Okay.
I couldn't have been happier in Arlington. I just love the people. I love the community. We had done so much together. We had built a brand new communication center, and that was a thrill in itself. But I was getting antsy. So I applied for this job in Montgomery County, and I was lucky again. Good fate, good fortune touched me again. So I agreed to take the job in Montgomery County, and I agreed to do that when it was offered to me in August of 2001. Just a couple of weeks later was 9/11.
Oh, wow.
That's kind of an interesting story in itself, if you don't mind. Let me just share that with you.
Yeah, definitely.
Many people know, and maybe many people don't know, that before 9/11 was known as 9/11, 9/11 was National 911 Day. And it had been that for 15, 16 years. Mm-hmm. There was to have been held on the Capitol grounds that morning, Tuesday, the 11th, a press conference that Nina was hosting. And Nina was at that press conference going to issue what he had already announced would be the report card of 911 in America. And I was planning to go there. I was at work in Arlington. The comm center there was on the fifth floor of a 7-story building. And I was in my office at about, 8-ish, a little after, and I was getting ready to go. And I was putting my necktie on in my office. And my office is right off the communications floor of the comm center. And somebody came to the door and said, Steve, before you do that, you need to come out here. And I came out. On our TV, we were watching live what was going on at in New York City. And right away, being a seasoned firefighter and a longtime public safety person, I knew darn well that this was not just a trash can fire that had gotten out of hand and caught the building afire. This was something different. I mean, remember those early hours and minutes, it was not really clear what was going on. There was a bit of confusion.
Yeah.
But it became very clear very quickly. And right before our eyes, we saw the second strike of the building. And I knew darn well that I'd never get to Capitol Hill. And I also knew darn well that this was a benchmark day in America's history. The world would be different. You just knew that, if you will. So we also began to wonder aloud. I mean, literally, it was chatter in the room as we watched what was going on in New York. And we were obviously concerned for what the firefighters were encountering. And my crew in Arlington were equally concerned about a group of people that they had never met, but they knew what they were doing, and that would be the 911 personnel in New York. And I know there was a lot of chatter about the kinds of calls that they were probably getting from people that we knew were trapped on the upper floors. Those last calls that some people may make and the requests that they probably were asking of the call takers, call my husband, call my wife, mm-hmm. tell them I love them, that kind of high emotional, very personal thing. But we were also wondering about two buildings in Arlington that were known as Arlington's Twin Towers. They were in the Roslyn section of Arlington, right across from the Georgetown area of Washington. And they were only 33-story buildings, but aside from their being shorter, they were in many ways very similar to the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering aloud, because we knew that bad guys were out there doing stuff.
Right.
And we wondered aloud whether or not they might not have the Twin Towers of Arlington kind of in their crosshairs. And we could see that building from where we were on the fifth floor. It was about eight blocks away, two buildings, I should say. And I took the opportunity to call the security office, which we already had the number for. And I said, listen, I don't know what's going on, and you don't either. But I said, if I could give you some suggestion, I think I'd get that building emptied as soon as I can. And I remember his words. He says, there's nobody left in this building. We're out of here.
Oh, wow.
So they were sensing that same sense of doom, if you will. Mm-hmm. But then the Comm Center in Arlington was also very close to National Airport. So we were very accustomed to airplanes flying over our building, usually on takeoff because of the flight path. But I was standing right at the window watching the TV, and it was that beautiful day. If you remember that day in September, was just absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It was just mild and just a beautiful cloudless day. And as I'm kind of almost leaning against the wall watching the TV that was mounted on the wall, I heard an airplane, and I looked out the window, and then what ended up being the flight that struck the Pentagon flew over our building. And there are certain things you just sense, in our world, and you knew that plane was going to hit something. It wouldn't be the buildings that we were suspicious of, because they were now behind the airplane. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that plane, went overhead and circled around and zeroed in on the Pentagon. And within a minute, we heard the explosion, saw the smoke, and the world changed right before our eyes. And that was another incredibly interesting experience. And the crew in Arlington County, they were just magnificent. I think you may have said in one of your introductory remarks about your show, Unsung Heroes.
Yes.
Our world, meaning the communications world, the 911 world, is just absolutely saturated with unsung heroes, and I am really glad and do appreciate your podcast providing an opportunity for some of those stories to be told, some of those people to be recognized, some of them to get the attention that they're so deserving of and so often don't even want. I mean, one of the things about people in our world, our profession, is that they're so humble. They're so modest. They don't want the recognition that they really deserve, but
right, definitely.
They deserve it. They should get it regardless of whether they want it or not. So anyhow, that was another multi-day experience that I'll never, ever forget. And we had an extraordinarily heavy role in the way in which that event was dispatched to the units from all over the country that responded, USAR teams coming in from all points of the compass, and some of the challenges that went with that. But again, we were prepared. If you read the 9/11 Commission report, there doesn't say many good things in that book. But there is a couple pages where they recognize some of the preparatory work that had been done in our area that really allowed for the Pentagon to be responded to and be managed from an incident management standpoint as well as it was. And a lot of people helped to make that happen before the fact, and they helped to execute it on 9/11. And that was another kind of a sad farewell to a long career in Arlington County. Mm-hmm. But it was just a real memorable day.
Now, with an incident like that, you know, what you went through as well, do you think there's any real training that can prepare somebody for that?
Two things that I have always tried to practice and preach. And please don't think myself as being gory because I say what I say, but I would, when I was under the headset, now I'm not under the headset anymore, and I just have the highest admiration for those that still do it. And quite frankly, sometimes I wish I could get up from my desk and just go down on the floor and don a headset and live that life all over again. But when I was under the headset, I would often play out in my mind a lot of what ifs. What if this happened, and what if that happened? Because of my 16 years in Washington, a lot of stuff happened, and a lot of that stuff was stuff that I had thought about as what if this happens and what if that happens. I had the good fortune of being on the radio on the tragic day when President Reagan was shot. I had the good fortune of being on the radio on the tragic day in January of 1982 when an airplane taking off from National Airport crashed into the 14th Street Bridge, into the ice-covered Potomac River, and it was just a mess. But those things, believe it or not, maybe not to a high level of detail, but from a what if it happened? What if an airplane took off and crashed? I had kind of played out in my mind. So when some of these things ended up happening, it wasn't like, oh my gosh, what do I do? It was kind of like, well, I thought about that, and
right,
and it went pretty well. The other thing that I've always tried to practice as well as to preach is dispatchers should think strategically and act decisively. Whether it's good or bad, and I don't want to get anybody in trouble when I say this, so take it for whatever it's worth. I've always operated on the premise that unless it says thou shalt not do something, that must mean it's okay to do it.
Right.
But you have to be in doing it. You have to do it, you know, with your head screwed on pretty good and thinking it through and thinking strategically. And I know because I've been on both sides of this equation, meaning in the field and under the microphone, that a dispatcher is an absolute incident command assistant if, one, they want to be, and two, the incident commander is receptive to all of the good things that a dispatcher can help her or him with on the firebrand. And if you think strategically and try to think ahead, keep in mind that an incident commander got a lot of stuff going on their minds as well. And how you say what you may say may be just absolutely incredibly helpful to them. For an example, chief, can you use something? And I've done that so many times, and they'll say, oh, yeah, yeah, that'd be good. You know, you're kind of giving them a little bit of incentive and a little bit of prodding when their mind is just swirling around with all right. kinds of stuff. But how you do that and the way you do that, the demeanor you use, the credibility that you have established that allows you to do that are very important. But they really allow for what you might call the mundane part of dispatching to take on a new level of engagement and an added level of satisfaction. So think strategically, act decisively.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And you're definitely right because it's all in the delivery. You know, if you say it the wrong way, it comes off bad as well. And you know, it just messes up, you know, an incident or something. Now, moving on from there, when did you move into your role in Fairfax?
Well, as I said, I went to Montgomery County, and that was going to be my last stop, if you will. but a bunch of things happened, all of them good. And I was drawn back to Virginia. So I only spent about 4.5 years in Montgomery County and found myself back in Virginia at a brand newly organized agency, the Fairfax County Department of Public Safety, that had just been created by removing dispatch and 911 from under the law enforcement agency and made it a separate independent department. One of the best things that ever happened for this agency, for sure. It may not be right for every agency, but for a large community like ours, 1.5 million people, it was the right thing to do at the right time. And I was very, very, very fortunate to be the first director, which is where I'm still at. It's my I'm pushing my 10th year. So I've been here for 10 years, and we've built a new building here as well. I would welcome your visitors visiting us online. If nothing else, it's fairfaxcounty.gov/911. And we've tried to put together a website that that is interesting and informative. There is video there. It gives you a visual tour of the building and the operations floor. It's big, no doubt about it. We're probably one of the 10 biggest 911 centers in the nation. We handle 1 million calls a year. We have 1.5 million residents. And there aren't many tools of our trade that we don't utilize. And we're very much preparing for both text to 911 and next generation 911. And we just have a lot of stuff going on, and it's just very, very, it's very invigorating. Every day I wake up, I'm an early riser, always have been, and can't wait to get to work. And I'm glad to get home sometimes, don't get me wrong, but it remains just a great, fun place to work and do good stuff.
How many dispatchers do you have working at a time?
We have about 45 personnel per shift.
Oh, wow.
We're consolidated, we're civilianized, and we're cross-trained. We're a little bit unusual in that our operations floor is shared with the Virginia Department of Transportation Traffic Management System for Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of your readers and maybe even you, Ricardo, have heard about the notoriously difficult traffic in Northern Virginia. It's mm-hmm. kind of what we're known for amongst many other good things. But there's a lot of traffic here. And we would spend in the old days before we co-located half of our time on the phone to VDOT asking for, what do you see in this lane in your camera, and what do you see in that lane, and we need you to block off this, and we need you to open up that, and can you give us a signboard message that says this and that? And it worked. But when given the opportunity to build a new building and to move into it and combine our services, although we're absolutely independent operationally and culturally, We work extraordinarily smoothly operationally and leverage each other's systems and technology and expertise, and we can do just a lot of cool stuff here that we could never do before. And also, we took the opportunity to move the state police barrack dispatchers for Northern Virginia, and it's a big district. It's a big region. And they're dispatched from our facility too, not by us, but they have their own area within the operations floor, because it too was another agency that we communicated an awful lot on and collaborated an awful lot on, but always on the phone. And now we don't have to do that. We're all here together, but we're respectful that we're independent, that we have our own cultures, but we work very, very well together. And we benefit from a building that none of us could have benefited from if we had tried to do it on our own. So if your viewers or if your listeners do go to the website, they'll see some stuff that's really pretty cool insofar as amenities and those things that dispatchers can really benefit from.
That's awesome. Now, what's your opinion on Texas 911?
I'm sorry, Ricardo, would you say that again?
What's your opinion on Texas 911?
I am supportive of it with some caveats.
Of course.
I should say, and I will say, that we are actively planning to transition to Texas 911 capability. I do know that there certainly is a segment of the population that needs it on a regular basis. And unfortunately, there's a segment of the population that could use it, may benefit from it on an as-needed basis. But it's ancillary to 911. We have already established our advertising campaign, if you will, or public information campaign when we launched Text to 911. And it will simply say, call if you can, text if you can't. Because just the fact that you can text to 911, I don't want everybody to text to 911.
Right, yeah.
There is so much benefit that goes with the conversational nature of a 911 call, and the call taker can benefit so much from what is being heard, both directly, the tone of voice, the background ambient noise. All of this is lost in the sterility of a text to 911 call.
Definitely.
But I know too, there are times when you can't practically or safely call 911. So texting will have its benefits. So
yes,
we're certainly looking forward to it. When we do it, we plan to integrate it completely within our system, separate and aside from next generation 911, because maybe you'll want to chat about that and I don't mind. But we'll be going to text to 911 in advance of going to next generation 911. And all of our call taking positions, we have 36 call taking positions. Mm-hmm. All 36 call taking positions will be equipped to answer text to 911 in the typical ACD manner. So it won't be one of those things where only one workstation can do it and stuff like that. It'll be integrated completely.
So going into the wrap-up of this episode, I'm wondering, how much different is 911 now from when you started?
There are certain parts of it that are dramatically different. But interestingly, I had some folks in the comm center the other day, and I said this, and I say it again to you because I think it's reflective, that fundamentally we do the same thing here in my agency, a big agency with a lot of calls and a lot of technology, that they do in the most rural 911 center in America that you could identify, that maybe has literally no technology and one or two people on duty and a rural area to protect of thousands of miles. I mean, fundamentally, it's the same. What is your emergency? Where is your emergency? And identify the right resources to send to that emergency and do it quickly and efficiently. But clearly, in the, it'll be 47 years, I guess, 47 years since 911 was initiated on February 16th of this month, February. We're just around the corner from the 47th anniversary. And the primary benchmarks, I think, of, I'll use the word evolution, was, of course, 911 itself. And we all know that that started in Healysville, Alabama. And then the next iteration was selective routing, and then it was followed by cellular 911, phase one and phase two, and then by VoIP 911, and now the fifth evolutionary stage, which is next generation 911. So it's incredible that although it has changed immensely in the tools that we have at our fingertips, the evolutionary milestones along the way are only five. And it's also amazing that even though the fundamental system is 47 years old, and certainly the equipment is newer, but the construct of the 911, the selective routing and all of the other hardware features have remained unchanged. And that's why the next generation of 911, where the only thing about the next generation of 911 that will be similar to the current generation of 911 will be the number 911. Everything else will be different. Right. How you call it, how it's routed, how it's processed, and how it's dispatched.
No, definitely. I want to thank you very much for being on this episode. Like I said, it's something I've wanted to do for a while now. Would love to have you on again.
Well, there are a lot more stories.
that would be great. We'll touch base here in just a moment. But like I said, thank you again for being on this episode. And for those listening, if you have any questions or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email us at wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. That's @911podcast. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this episode will be up and available 24/7 on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, and thejabberlog.com. Have a good one.